You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 36th week of the year from September 2nd to September 8th, covering Numbers 6:22 to Numbers 11:6. Numbers 6:22 says, the verse says, God spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, So shall you bless the children of Israel, saying to them, May God bless you and safeguard you, may God illuminate his countenance for you and be gracious to you. May God lift his countenance to you and establish peace for you. This, if you ever saw the movie Fiddler on the Roof, you might recognize this as the blessing that the parents say to the children on the Sabbath, in a song, at least in the musical. But this is what's known as the priestly blessing. This is the blessing that the priests say to the Israelites on certain days of the year. And if you go into a synagogue on certain Jewish holidays, you can actually hear the priests, the descendants of the priests, people named Kohen or Cohen, go to the front of the synagogue and say this blessing to the congregation, although they're doing it in Hebrew. But it's also the blessing that the Jewish fathers make on their children on the Sabbath. It's a powerful blessing. It's a passionate wish for peace and God consciousness for another person. And the blessing works in both directions. Being blessed this way instills faith and a conscious contact with God. Making the blessing on another person is also spiritually powerful. It makes you spiritually generous, which is healthy for recovery and sobriety. So if you can imagine you walk into a meeting, and in addition to shaking hands and getting a cup of coffee, you say to everybody in the room, May God bless you and safeguard you. May God illuminate his countenance for you and be gracious to you. Maybe, I don't know, people might think you're strange, but the spirit of it, I think, is important. It might make you feel better. And wishing other people blessing, and I think might make them feel better too if they really are paying attention. Numbers 8:1 to 8:2 reads, God spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and say to him, When you kindle the lamps of the menorah, toward the face of the menorah shall the seven lamps cast light. Now, I think most of us have seen images of the menorah. It's a candelabrum with seven branches. On the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, they have ones that have eight branches, plus a center candle or lamp. The menorah that's described in the Bible had a light in the center and three arms on each side for a total of seven lamps. And they were oil lamps, like dishes of olive oil with a wick in it. Now people use candles, it's easier. Moses is told to relate God's instructions about the menorah to Aaron, the high priest, who is commanded to light it. Okay? And the wicks are supposed to point toward the center light. So imagine that on each side, the wicks are sort of angled, pointing towards the center. Question is, why? Why would this be required? So one commentary is that the intent was to concentrate the light in the center in order to show that God is the source of all light and did not need extra light to illuminate the tabernacle. And so we can learn something from this, which is that one way to look at this is that God is the source of all recovery. God is the source of light in our lives. We can organize our recovery around that idea. There's another question, which is, why should Aaron light the menorah at all. You know, why should we undertake the rituals and processes of recovery if God alone is the source of everything? So one answer to this is that we have to do our part to connect with God as a source of all light. We need to take action and seek conscious contact with God. If we seek God, God usually responds to us. We can't simply sit back and do nothing and expect God to light up our lives. Although usually if you can't do anything, God may come to you anyway. But there's an expectation. I think God has an expectation that we're going to do some of the work ourselves. So continuing with Numbers 8:1, God spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you kindle the lamps of the menorah, toward the face of the menorah shall the seven lamps cast light." So this expression, towards the face of the menorah, means that the three wicks on each side of the menorah were pointing towards the center. So another interpretation of this instruction is that you have two, basically, branches of the menorah, one on the right and one on the left. Three on the right, three on the left, one in the middle. We've seen pictures of this. It's depicted in a lot of artwork. It's also, if you're curious about things like this, if you go to Rome and visit the Arch of Titus, you can see a stone carving of the Roman soldiers carrying this menorah out of the temple when they destroyed the temple in Jerusalem in the year 70. Anyway, one interpretation of this is that the wicks on the left side represent the day-to-day activities of people in their lives, and the wicks on the right represent people who engage in spiritual activities like Bible study, Torah learning. So the idea you can take out of this is that both types of activities are important to your life, and that both take spirituality and practicality, and it should all be directed towards God, meaning that if you have a spiritual practice in your life, that's important, but you also need to have a practical practice, so to speak, in your life. And the question that comes up is, can you create a spiritual connection with God in ordinary life? You know, can you achieve conscious contact with God when you're filling up your car with gas, for example? I mean, it sounds silly, but this, I think, is worth trying. And maybe you're not going to have some huge spiritual epiphany while you're filling up your car, but if you can, in my experience, if you can infuse the day-to-day activities of your life with a holy sense, it will improve your conscious contact with God. And for example, there are many things that we do where we could probably think about being grateful, having gratitude to God for what we have. You know, if you're filling up your car, you could have gratitude that you have a car and that you have money to get gas and there's gas available and you have somewhere to go. So you can elevate even the most mundane of activities. That's what it means to shine the light on the center of the menorah, that you bring together the practical and spiritual parts of your life. Numbers 9:15 says, "On the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle that was a tent for the testimony, and in the evening they would be upon the tabernacle like a fiery appearance until morning." So this is a new topic. The Bible is describing how once the tabernacle was set up, there was a cloud. Imagine like a cloud from the sky that came down to cover it. And at night, this cloud would appear to be on fire, like a fiery cloud. And the Bible refers to this as a cloud of glory. And it's understood to be a symbol of God's presence. So God reminded the Israelites in the wilderness that he was present with them through this cloud. So by day it was a cloud, and by night it was like a fire, like a, some people translate it as a pillar of fire. I think also, once again, if you watch the movie The Ten Commandments, you can see a depiction of what this pillar of fire looked like. So it must have been quite a sight. And it was a constant reminder that God was there, that God was present. And you can imagine that this was comforting to the Israelites, that they were, you know, out in the wilderness, in the middle of nowhere, with no natural resources. They had just escaped from centuries of slavery. They were scared, you know, even though they had faith. This was a reminder that God was there. Now, we don't have this today. We don't have like a little cloud following us around that to remind us that God is with us. But the challenge on us is to believe that God is with us, even though we can't see God. And I think we can, maybe you can imagine that you have a cloud or a pillar of fire following you around day by day, and that our paths are illuminated by this pillar of fire, or that we're protected by this cloud of glory. That's our challenge. It has to be something that we imagine. Numbers 9:18 continues with this cloud, saying, "According to the word of God would the children of Israel journey, and according to the word of God would they encamp. All the days that the cloud would rest upon the tabernacle, they would encamp." So the cloud of glory had several different purposes. It was this symbol of God's presence, but it was also kind of like a traffic signal. When it started to move, the Israelites knew that it was time to start moving. And that's how, if you ever wondered, how did the Israelites know to move and stop in the wilderness? The answer is they would follow the cloud, and at night they would follow the pillar of fire. So this was, you know, otherwise, if the cloud stayed still, the Israelites would stay put, and they would stay put for as long as it took. You know, it could be a day or a year, it didn't matter. So in recovery, one idea that you can take out of this is a pretty familiar topic, but it's worth visiting in this context, which is the idea of doing a geographic. And I think we've all thought about this or done it at one time or another, which is to contemplate moving to a different place, maybe a new city or a new country. We're going to start over again. We're going to leave all of our problems behind. Now, of course, it doesn't usually work like that. I mean, there are reasons to move, and it can help. I've seen it help. But generally speaking, if you have problems as a result of addiction or a not good recovery program, you're going to have problems wherever you go. Maybe not right away, but pretty soon you're going to have the same stuff. You're still yourself. You bring your problems with you. So one thing to think about for this verse is that, you know, God has a sense of where you should be. And so in this sense, you know, maybe God will tell you stay put, or maybe God will tell you to move. But it's not something that you should decide all on your own. It's something you need to seek, you know, spiritual guidance for, from a sponsor, or pray for God's will for you to understand what you really need to be doing. Do you need to stay put, or do you need to move? Is it really a good idea to move? And so forth. Numbers 9:20-9:22 reads, "Sometimes the cloud would be upon the tabernacle for a number of days, according to the word of God. They would encamp, and according to the word of God would they journey. And sometimes the cloud would remain from evening until morning, and the cloud would be lifted in the morning, and they would journey." So, like I said, the cloud would stay still for as long as God wanted the Israelites to stay encamped in their camp. And when the cloud moved, they would move. And as the verse indicates, sometimes the cloud would remain in place for a day or two, or a month, or a year. Doesn't matter. Whenever it moved, they moved. But an issue comes up, which is how do you live your life if you don't know if you're going to be moving the next day or if you're being staying put for a year? And you have to remember that the Israelites had a lot of children. They had livestock. They had, you know, tents, and they had the tabernacle. They were camping out, but they had a lot of stuff. And, you know, if I don't know about you, but if I thought, well, if I have to move every day, I'm not going to unpack everything. I'll just sort of, you know, sit tight and see what happens. But you can't. And that's what God, I think, was trying to teach the Israelites, which is that you don't know what's going to be happening in your life, and you can't wait. You have to do what you need to do at the moment. And what the commentators say is that the Israelites treated every stop on the journey as if it was long-term, no matter what would happen. Like, they would, when the cloud stopped, they would stop, they would unpack everything, they would set up everything about their complete day-to-day life and start over again. And the truth is, they didn't know they might have to move the very same day, or they might sit there for a year. So there's a great life lesson in this, which applies to recovery, which is that it's good to take action if you can take action and not wait. There is a temptation to say, well, you know, I have an important thing to do, I'll do that when things are a little more settled. You know, I'll do my fourth step when I've calmed down a little bit. I'll do my fourth step when I've finished painting my apartment, or whatever it is that you're doing that's less important. And the problem with that, I think, as we've seen, is that you end up delaying, or maybe you just never do it. You know, you see this all the time. So this verse can be a motivator to just get moving and do what you need to do, because you're never going to get settled enough to do what you need to do. If you have that mindset, if you're waiting for life to go on pause before you do the work of recovery, you're probably not going to get very far. Numbers 11:4-11:6 reads, "The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving, and the children of Israel also wept once more and said, 'Who will feed us meat? We remember the fish we ate in Egypt, free of charge, the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now our life is parched. There is nothing. We have nothing to anticipate but the manna.'" So this is a verse that describes another incident of ingratitude on the part of the Israelites. And you have to look at it in context. Now, on one hand, I think you can have some empathy for the Israelites. I mean, they're in the desert. They're sort of disoriented, and they're eating manna, which, although it's a miracle, it's the same thing every day. But what they're not appreciating is, here's a group of people that's been freed from centuries of slavery, from crushing, soul-destroying slavery by miraculous acts of God. They've been led out. They've defeated this group of slaves, these nobodies, has defeated the most powerful king in the world. God has destroyed Pharaoh. God has led them to freedom. God has given them the Torah. It's the greatest spiritual revelation in the history of humanity. They've been kept alive by miraculous food that falls from the sky. And what is their problem? What are they upset about? They're worried about the cucumbers. They miss those cucumbers. Right. After all this miraculous recovery, they're pissed off about that they don't have cucumbers and leeks. And boy, this should probably sound a little familiar to us who have had problems with alcohol and drugs. Think about it like this. If you had a serious addiction problem, you're probably lucky to be alive. That's the truth. If you're sober, it's because God wanted to give you another chance at life. Yet, the addict's nature is to be dissatisfied. Nothing is good enough. Life is terrible. I think we've all seen this kind of behavior. We've probably all done this kind of behavior at one point or another in recovery. The disease of addiction is such that it makes you resent what you've been given, even though it saved your life. And when you feel this way, acting out and drinking or using drugs seems to be like a solution. Like, what a good idea, right? It's like an anesthetic to make it all go away. But if we can only see what is really going on in these moments, we might have a little more clarity. Like the Israelites, we have been delivered from the slavery of addiction, yet we complain about our state of affairs. If we could think clearly, we would be in gratitude. And that is the choice we need to make.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily Reflections on Recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com